Friday this month. We usually do it on a Wednesday, but my travel schedule didn't allow for that. We will also have a recording of this webcast available, like all of our webcasts that we are doing using this particular software. They're typically available within a couple of hours or so as an archive. Just go to sans.org/webcasts and you should find a link to archived webcasts on that particular page. I want to mention our sponsor again, Core Security Technologies. Thanks to Core for making this podcast possible and for the great products they're creating. Well, we have a quick outline for you. In some ways, I guess I couldn't have scheduled it better with the travel disruption and such, because we just went to InfoComm Yellow. I haven't checked it when we went last, but I don't think we went last year to InfoComm Yellow ever, because, well, we really didn't have sort of these widespread internet threats as we used to have them when we first devised the InfoComm. The InfoComm was really more devised around sort of worms like we had back with Code Red, Blast, and all of that, and not so much for the more modern bot threats. Actually, Adam earlier this week sort of posted a little bit about the InfoComm, which triggered amongst ourselves a little bit of discussion whether or not we want to revise it. Well, with the unrevised version, we still went to Yellow today over the RDP issue that Microsoft patched earlier this week, and of course, with that, we will devote a good part of this webcast to the RDP problem and how to secure RDP regardless of the particular vulnerability. With that, let's go on and talk about the Microsoft patches. Well, you had a total of six bulletins. One of them, the RDP one, was the only critical one. Many of the others are denial of service or elevation of privilege vulnerabilities, which of course typically makes them less critical or more important. Now, first one here, MS-12-17. This one is a denial of service in Microsoft's DNS server. Microsoft rated this as important. We only rated it as important for the server. We didn't really rate it anything, or because none applies for the client, because, well, your client doesn't run a DNS server. The exact nature of the queries that trigger this behavior appears to be unknown. Microsoft is not releasing that. However, there's some indication that these are more or less standard queries, maybe just an exhaustion of cache memory if you are querying too many host names that are then being cached. Really not so clear. Once that becomes widely known, it should be relatively easy to exploit this particular vulnerability with tools like Dig and such. Patch your DNS servers, no question about that. I wouldn't lose too much sleep over that. You can also evade some of that problem, according to Microsoft, if you're just regularly flushing your DNS server cache. So that may be a workaround in case you're subject to an attack and you then need to react quickly and you hadn't applied this particular patch yet. Next, MS-12-018, kernel mode drivers, elevation of privileges. Well, this is an old one. We keep having these issues. The problem here is really that it's a very target-rich environment. There's a huge attack surface here. You have all these drivers that run in the kernel with kernel privileges. So if there is a leak in one of these drivers, then of course you will get system access. Now, on the other hand, these drivers also provide a very large range of functions, which again makes them very susceptible to attack. I just listed some of the prior bulletins from the last couple of years, and this was really just a quick Google search I did here. So there are probably many, many more. I think sort of every other month or so, there's one of these kernel mode driver elevation of privilege issues that is being mentioned here. Next, we have a direct write denial of service. This will crash a system. It is really more of a client issue. I wouldn't expect this to be a big issue for servers. The bug is triggered if the system is asked to display Unicode characters, and it has to be a specific sequence of Unicode characters. So on a server, you usually don't really display stuff, in particular not sort of a lot of untrusted user input. That's why I don't really think this is a big issue for servers. It's really more of a client issue. And the denial of service on a client, I don't really consider that terribly important. So again, nothing to lose any sleep over. Just patch it as you get around to do your standard patching. And then, well, the big one, and that's the RDP remote code execution. This one is critical. Now, we did not write this on the client. On the client, you typically do not have RDP enabled. RDP is really more of a server functionality. However, regardless, I think there are a lot of clients out there that have RDP enabled sort of for remote support and such. So here I really would say patch now if you have it enabled on the client. This vulnerability is very critical, as we learned earlier today. An exploit is really imminent about this. Now, there are two vulnerabilities here. The one that everybody's talking about is 2012-2. That's a CVE number for it. That's the RDP remote code execution. There is a second vulnerability being addressed here, and that's a terminal server denial of service. So the second one is just denial of service. The first one is the dangerous one, the remote code execution. Some of the exploits claim to exploit the second one, denial of service. Some of the exploits claim to exploit the first one. However, they don't actually execute any code. They're only crashing the system. So there's a little bit of gray zone here with these exploits that have been released so far. And then, as I mentioned earlier, there are a lot of fake exploits out here. I think I've never seen that many fake ones for a vulnerability like this. They're advertised all over the place. Be really, really careful before you use anything like that for a pen test or such. Rapid7, the company behind Metasploit, also put out a bounty as of this morning for the first one to come up with a working exploit. Personally, from a defensive point of view, if I would use this as part of a pen test or such, wait until the Metasploit version is out, and don't rush and grab the next best exploit. Just a little bit more details about this. Like I said, later we'll talk more about securing RDP regardless of this particular vulnerability. This vulnerability was originally found in May 2011, and it was actually reported via Tipping Point. Tipping Point has this survey initiative where they pay people for bugs, and then they report them to vendors. Microsoft learned of it in late August 2011. So it took Microsoft 6 months to come out with a patch. I don't really think that's overly long on this. I'm not sure that delay, whether that was the original discovery that led to this delay to report to Microsoft, or whether that was something at a Tipping Point site that led to the delay. As far as I know, the original discoverer actually did not write a working remote code execution vulnerability, so there may have been some issue as to whether or not the bug was actually exploitable. Now, it's a use-after-free vulnerability, and RDP is based on this ITU protocol at T125, and a particular part of this very set to max channel IDs, that's the vulnerable parameter here. Snort signatures and such shouldn't be that terrible to write for it. I haven't seen one yet, but I would expect SourceFire to have come out with one at least for the subscribers. If you're interested in all the nitty-gritty details of this vulnerabilities and how to exploit it, here is a URL of the guy that actually discovered it, and he goes into quite some detail on how to possibly exploit this vulnerability, but I don't think he goes beyond showing the actual denial of service part, where the system is just being crashed. But this was just released this morning, this URL, at least to my knowledge. That's when I saw it. So I hadn't really had a lot of time to digest that. Well, and then we have more vulnerabilities, MS-12021, Visual Studio Elevation of Privileges. This is very similar to the DLL linking issue. In Visual Studio, you have the ability to load add-ons as you start Visual Studio. Those add-ons may be loaded from untrusted locations. If the add-on is located in your current directory and you are opening Visual Studio from your current directory. An exploit scenario I could see here is where someone is sending you some code, bunch of files, you unzip them, you go into that directory, you open Visual Studio, and within all those files that you were sent, there is a malicious add-on. So really the impact here is quite low. First of all, it really only affects clients. You're not going to run typically Visual Studio on a server, but not too many people have Visual Studio installed in the first place. They're usually developers that have it installed. Instead of accepting random code like this, I would think that's somewhat unusual, so I don't really think that this is a big deal. Like the others, where I said it's not a big deal. They'll get around and patch it, but that's about it. And then again, I just mentioned insecure DLL loading. We got one of these two, and that's in Expression Design. That's a Microsoft software, so if you have that installed, again, patch it. So as far as patch priorities go, and let me actually just go for that to the overview. I didn't have a slide that shows all the patch and priority, but MS-12020 is the one patch that you really have to apply this time, and then I would just go down the list from there. One thing with the DNS server, denial of service patch, I didn't mention. I've seen some reports that it does not get applied automatically if you don't have the DNS server component enabled. So double check whether it got actually applied. There may be cases where you sort of have a standby DNS server where DNS is not actually enabled normally, but you have it ready in case you need it, and then you'll enable it. You probably want to make sure that this is patched. On the client side, I think these kernel mode drivers is probably the next one after the RDP one, and then the direct write denial of service. But well, with that, let me move ahead here, and let's talk about securing RDP. So what is this RDP protocol about? Well, if you're using Windows, you probably know it's the remote desktop service. It used to be known as terminal services. Around for quite a while, like terminal services, I think its first showing was in Windows NT 4 server. That's when it sort of came to life. And it is really still the way how Windows administrators sort of remotely, interactively administer a server. Yes, a lot of this can be scripted with WMIC and such, now with PowerShell, but if you need sort of remote troubleshooting, if you need to interact with a server, then probably RDP is how you do it, and there is no real good other way to do it in many cases. Now, RDP had, as a protocol, a little bit speckled security history. The protocol itself is actually encrypted. It uses RC4, which is a decent cipher. That cipher part is implemented well in terminal services, as far as I can tell, based on reading up on it. However, the initial connection setup has a problem. The client never actually validates in the default configuration whether or not it connects to the right server. It's really very much like using SSL without really using trusted certificates. Very similar issues here that then lead to a man-in-the-middle attack. So the problem here is that the server, as part of the connection setup, after client sort of asked for connection initiated, is sending a public key to the client and a salt. The salt is really just a random number. The client is creating its own random number. The client salt encrypts it using the public key and it's passing it back to the server. The problem is the client never really checks whether or not it uses a trusted public key. So that then leads to a man-in-the-middle attack. And going forward for the RC4 part of connection, the key is derived using the server salt and the client salt. So the way the man-in-the-middle works is that the man-in-the-middle here receives the public key and the server salt. Nothing really that can be done with that. Then the man-in-the-middle here is sending its own public key and the server salt onto the client. The client responds. It now encrypts the salt, the client salt, with the man-in-the-middle certificate. The man-in-the-middle can decrypt it and then pass it on to the server using the public key it received from the server. So the problem here is the client never really checks whether or not the key that was used to as part of the connection is actually trusted and valid. Okay, now in Windows XP Service Pack 2 and later, Microsoft added a fix for that. The key that is being created by the server, that public certificate, is now actually properly signed using another key. The problem is it's the same key for every single instance of Windows. So if you install Windows, with it comes a private key. That key is then used to sign your certificate that you are using as a server to offer remote desktop services. So of course with that, everybody in the world knows what the key is, and now the man-in-the-middle attack works pretty much the same way, just the man-in-the-middle has to make sure that the key is properly signed using this secret key, which of course everybody has. Plenty of tools that implement this attack, so it's not a hard attack to pull off. Kinenable is probably the most popular one here that does it sort of in a nice GUI fashion. And as a result, really, RDP should be secured beyond default settings. So how do you do that? Well, more recently, Microsoft came up with new ways to authenticate, and that's really the network level authentication. With network level authentication, you now use essentially Active Directory, but use a central resource to authenticate. So now you can use Kerberos, now you can use SLTLS to authenticate, and if you do this, and if you set it up properly, then this man-in-the-middle problem will go away and your authentication to RDP will be a lot safer. So that's definitely something you should do. Now, if you don't have Active Directory and if you can't implement Kerberos, for example, or SLTLS, then another option that you can use is to only use RDP over a VPN connection. So that's another sort of security solution that you may want to implement. And in this case, I would try to terminate the VPN connection on the server itself. So that would mean on the server itself, you're running the VPN server. In addition to that, in order for any of this to really work and be applicable, you have to run at least Windows 2003. So if you're still running Windows 2000 as such, really a lot of this, like network level authentication or so, may not work for you. And then there are a couple of other sort of best practices that you can apply. First of all, you can limit which users have access to RDP. Regardless of this particular vulnerability, the number one risk that you have if you're running an RDP server is password brute forcing. If you looked at the port scans for RDP, we didn't really see a big increase so far. Well, I haven't actually checked today, but when I checked yesterday, it was pretty flat. But it's a very actively probed port all the time. And what they're looking for is just a weak usernames and password. With that, I would not allow the administrator to directly connect via RDP. Use a normal user account and just make it part of a remote desktop users group and then give that group access to RDP. This also has the other advantage that you now have better accountability. Everybody logs in using their own account, not some more or less anonymous and generic administrator account. The other thing you can do is just need your basic account security, strong passwords, lock out the account if there's a number of unsuccessful login attempts. Consider two-factor, in particular if you're doing network level authentication, that's an option you have. It's also not that hard to change the port that RDP is listening on. I would recommend that. It is a little bit security by obscurity, but the one scenario we are really afraid of here is that this will develop into a worm. Worms usually don't scan all of your ports. So use a port that's not in any of the default services lists, and it will significantly improve the security of your RDP services. I personally do this for a while now for SSH, which has similar issues with brute forcing. And yes, with SSH, you have other ways to mitigate this with keys and such. But just by moving SSH to an off port, I don't remember when I've seen the last time someone actually probing this port for usernames and passwords. So it definitely significantly improves your security here. And it also keeps down the noise in your logs. Yeah, and then, of course, whatever port you use, limit access to that port with the Windows firewall. Limit access from trusted networks only. Again, in a warm scenario, if now one of the systems in your network is infected, that may not help you much, but it does help against all the random kind of scanning that you will see. Another option to consider that you also have to secure is RDP can be tunneled over HTTP. One of the strengths and actually features of RDP is that it's really independent of the underlying protocol. So yes, usually use a TCP/IP directly, but you can run it over HTTP. Microsoft allows you to do that with the Terminal Services Web. This connection is not directly vulnerable to this attack. However, of course, the RDP server behind it still remains vulnerable. The actual Terminal Services Web, let me call it a proxy, should be on a separate machine than the actual RDP server to allow for some protection and isolation here. Now, it just happens that the beginning of the month, on March 1st, you had a diary by Boyan. Now, Boyan was talking about logging and how to log a failed login attempt. Just mention that's definitely something you want to keep an eye on. Be careful with your logging. If you are using network level access, network level authentication, what will happen is that now the actual failed login is logged at Active Directory server, whoever provides the authentication, not at the actual remote desktop service. Also, the error codes changed. So if you're looking at your logs, if you don't really know what's happening, look at Bojan's diary here. He has all the details about how to make sure that you understand what you're logging. Try to log into your remote desktop service with a wrong username, with a wrong password, and see how this is reflected in your logs so you know you'll actually be able to detect it. Well, with that, if RDP has problems, what alternatives do you have? I listed a couple here. The short summary is there isn't really anything that's significantly better if you are using Windows. VNC is another popular alternative and actually also uses a similar protocol, but really installing a third-party VNC server is, in my opinion, the worst or a secure alternative because it's now less integrated with everything else Windows is doing, and as a result, harder to secure. Also, VNC typically just has sort of one global password for all connections. VNC by itself is not encrypted at all, so not even RC4. You have to tunnel it in order to secure it. Now, SSH, of course, that's another option that you can use. If you are coming with a Unix background like myself, then, of course, SSH is well known to you, and that's how you usually administer a Unix system remotely. Again, it's not a default Windows component, so as a result, you have to install extra software, you have to patch additional software. Not pretty overall, but it can work, like I said, for smaller shops if you don't want to do the full VPN, if you don't have sort of central authentication, then this may be useful. Now, I sometimes see services like LogMe in and such mentioned as an alternative. These services should not be used to remotely administer a system. The only purpose of them is to remotely assist, I would say, a user with whom you don't sort of have a pre-established trust relationship, so you don't necessarily have keys exchanged and such. And let's say in a typical customer service environment, helping relatives over the phone, that's where LogMe can be helpful, but it's not a server admin tool by any means. And then, of course, there are a number of sort of command line options. I mentioned WMIC, the remote server administration tool and such. RS-AT is a little bit of a newer thing. I think it came in Windows 2008. Not sure if it's available in prior versions of Windows. They can do a lot of things, and a lot of things can be done easier using those tools than doing a full sort of remote desktop connection. But still, I don't think you can do without RDP in many cases. Try to do it, and if you can, great. But if you're not a Windows administrator, if you're just a security guy, don't beat up on the Windows guys too hard for having RDP enabled. Rather, make sure that it's properly secured as well as it can be secured. So much about RDP. Like I said, the patch now, that's really the best thing you can do. If you want to point relatives and such to easy assistance on this, I am in the process of recording a little video that sort of walks you through the settings of making sure that this patch is applied. Essentially, the quick summary here is check your updates in your control panel. The problem here is that it only shows the knowledge base number, so you have to know the right knowledge base number to actually verify whether or not this update is applied, and it's a little bit messy, that entire dialogue, to find the right thing. Well, anyway, originally I planned to spend more time on Android, but with RDP here being the big issue, I kept the Android slides pretty short and may cover them later in a later webcast. The reason I want to cover it is because we really see a pretty big increase in Android now. One of the later numbers I've seen is about 10,000 known samples. The advantage we have at this point is that even though it's sort of 10,000 distinct samples, they really only break down in about 20 different families. So there are really 20 different kinds of Android malware. The rest are small modifications of one of these 20 families. One recent study looked at Android anti-malware that has been available for a while now. The quick summary on this is, well, it's no better than what you have for the desktop. It's signature-based. It just doesn't work very well. There are a couple of, they tested, I think it was about 30 or 40 different Android anti-malware packages. 6-7 of them are pretty good, as in detected 90%+. However, that still means, you know, 1 out of every 10, 1 out of every 20 samples does make it past those products. Some of the products offered didn't detect a single one of the malware samples that they used to test. So definitely a lot of chunk out there, like, you know, obvious garbage, not just sort of commercial software that doesn't work quite right. And then what we have seen is that, like in the desktop world, Android malware is very much focusing in on financial information, and more people use their smartphone for financial information access, for banking access, as a security token, and the malware is really just going after that information. Now, how does it get in your phone? Well, so far, luckily, we see very little, if any, sort of drive-by exploits, as we kind of see a lot in the Windows world, where a user goes to a malicious website and then some exploit is used to install the particular malware. What we see more in the Android world is people just install it. Now, why would someone install malware? Typically not because it says, hey, this is great malware that will steal all your monies. What's very common in the Android malware world is that a popular piece of software, legitimate software, is used, and then malicious components are being added, and then it's re-released, typically under the same name as the original or a slightly different name, cheaper or for free if the original costs money, and then essentially the attacker is just hoping for someone to pick it up. And what we've seen so far, they easily get a few thousand people to pick it up before it's being removed from the respective Android marketplace. Now, there are a bunch of different Android marketplaces out there. Some of them, of course, are just rogue marketplaces and you won't see it removed there. In order to find the particular software in that case, well, you typically would see an advertisement via spam, see a lot of Twitter spam advertising Android malware. Now, why is it so easy to push it out? In part, this is based on how Android software works. Android software is usually compiled in Java. Then sort of for Android, there are these .dx files that are for the particular Android virtual machine. So a developer compiles the Java classes into these .dx files, adds any resource that may be required by them, adds a manifest, which is an XML file, and then zips it up. That zip file is the APK file, the Android package that you typically download from the marketplace. The manifest now tells the phone, once it unzipped that package, what to start in what order. So what a malicious author could do is download an existing package, add their own Java file, compile it, and then just change the manifest to add this particular malware to the executables. So a user may not even see anything odd happening. The software may work as advertised. Just before it runs that particular malicious component. Now, Android software is signed, but it's a little bit like what we talked about earlier with the RDP man in the middle part, that there is no sort of central authority that would hand out signatures. An Android developer essentially creates their own key and uses it to publish it. So unless a key is known to be used for malicious purposes, well, you don't know any better than to trust it. Now, other problems with Android, of course, is there is no pre-approval needed to publish something in the Android marketplace. Google started adding some automatic scanning, and like I said, they have become pretty fast now in removing malicious content, but it can take a day or so to have it removed, and the initial scanning they're doing before it's being published is still, you know, sort of in its infancy. It's also signature-based, as far as I can tell at this point. So new malware may definitely still make it in the official Android marketplace. And then again, like I said, there are lots of other marketplaces that are not controlled by Google. That's part of the point of Android, to have this sort of open ecosystem that everybody can publish software without asking for approval, like in the iOS case. So it's not that hard to publish malicious software. In iOS, if you want to publish in the official Apple App Store, it has to go through Apple's approval, and while I'm not necessarily perfect there, so far it has worked quite well. And essentially what they're doing as part of the approval process is to check whether or not any odd APIs or so are being used. The other problem is that, yes, the software will ask for permission to access certain resources. However, it's not always that clear for the user what you actually agree on. There are really sort of a couple of labels for certain permission groups, where by allowing access to, let's say, your location, you do allow access to a number of other features. So that could potentially be a problem, but the user just doesn't know what they actually click on here. And the opposite also wouldn't be ideal. You know, otherwise, you would have to agree to like dozens of sort of small permissions. Instead, the way Google went is, hey, let's bundle those permissions into these groups and make them more or less implicit, so the user only has to click OK once or twice, not a dozen times. Just here to close off, a little example of recent malware. I found this one particularly intriguing. It was found by McAfee, and it is banking malware. Now, the way this works is it actually claims to be a one-time password token for your bank. So you download it, you think, hey, I'm now more secure. I have a one-time password token for my bank. In order to use it, you need to enter your username and password. And that username and password is then, of course, sent to the attacker. So it's kind of like a phishing app in that sense. That way, the attacker now has the first factor of your authentication. Now, if your bank sends actually a second factor of authentication via SMS, this application will then intercept the SMS and forward it to the attacker. So this way, the attacker now bypassed two-factor authentication, and the user thinks they downloaded a one-time password token for their particular bank. And as you can see from the screenshots here, they are pretty decent in sort of, you know, emulating the use and feel of these particular banks. The other thing that has been seen recently was an application that then steals the phone's serial number, this IMEI number, and the attacker will then use that serial number to report the phone as stolen and then order a replacement SIM card that then, of course, is a clone of the user's original card, which then can be used to receive one-time passwords and SMS messages. I think that's rather elaborate, and I haven't seen that particular scheme yet, but this malicious application that forwards SMS messages is definitely something that has been out there for a while now. So anyway, this is it for today. We got a couple minutes. If anybody has any questions, as I mentioned before, the webcast will be archived. Sorry for having it sort of on an odd day today. And the next webcast should be again on the Wednesday after Patch Tuesday. Well, if we don't have any questions, then I'll just stop the recording here, and I'll leave this slide up a couple seconds before we close the room, just in case you have any more questions, of course, just send them to this email address. Also, if you listen to this recording, to this webcast as a recording, again, just use the email address for any questions.